You're listening to Read Between the Letting with Aaron Heath
and Matt McInerney.
It's October 11, 2009. Today we're talking to Robin Waxman of the Designers Accord. We'll be discussing design's role in doing good and the shifting paradigm of the design world involved with making a statement. We'll also touch on her role as an educator, an activist, and a quote-unquote farmer. Stay tuned. All right, everyone. Thanks for listening. Today on the show, we have Robin Waxman. And although I would like to try to introduce her and the many things that she does, it's a little difficult, so I'm going to let her talk about her history, how she got here, and then what exactly she's involved with. Robin, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I have a lot of titles, so I'll just read you what my business card says. So my business card says designer, activist, educator, farmer.
That's a good way to start.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I listed designer first because I think that's where I would start with that. And I think that's what I identify most with. And then the other ones I listed are not necessarily in priority order, but they seem to be where I'm at right now.
Mm. And so where are you at? You're first off a designer. How did you, when you were a kid, what made you think you wanted to be a designer? And where'd you get your education at? How did you become a designer?
I actually, growing up, I was not, I never thought of myself as a designer. My sister was the artist in the family. And I always wanted to do that, but I never really thought of myself in that way. And so I ended up going to undergrad at University of Delaware for pre-veterinary medicine, which is
interesting.
Pretty random stuff. But mostly I found because I was interested in animals at the time, and I was interested in helping animals because at somewhere around 16, I decided in the middle of a family trip to Alaska that I would be a vegetarian just right there and then. And that was the beginning of my political mindedness and environmental mindedness was back then. And I've actually stuck with it since. So I'm 39 and I'm still a vegetarian, although my mother said it was a phase. But anyway, I started that way. And when I finally did get to University of Delaware, I found out that they had a very good graphic communication program. So after a few stints on the farm, which is, you know, interesting how that comes full circle. Mm-hmm. One in particular was when we had to artificially inseminate a cow. And growing up in Miami Beach and never even really having touched a cow, I was pretty much the last student to go. And the cow had pretty much had it by the time I went. And, you know, I was wearing this giant glove up to my shoulder, sticking my arm up the cow's ass, pretty much massaging its, I'm not even sure what it was called. It's been too long. And the cow ended up exploding all over me. And at that point, I realized that maybe I should check out that graphic communication program on the other end of campus. So I promptly changed my major to art, and I needed to take some other classes to get prepared for it. But I actually went in pretty naive, not even really sure what graphic communication was or what graphic design really was. I just knew it was a way for me to do art and my parents would actually allow it. So at the time, you know, and being 19 years old, I went and I did that and I realized that this was exactly what I wanted, that it fed right into the idea of the image and how image is able to influence people to do things and change their behavior in a way that I felt that I think that's what I was originally getting to when I wanted to be a veterinarian was being politically minded and speaking for the animals at the time, but that I could actually do this on a lot larger level than just being a vegetarian or just speaking for the animals. I could do this for speaking for anyone who is in trouble, you know, anti-war and anti-poverty kind of movements. And so I really, out of just my naivety, got very lucky and found a way that I could apply creativity and art that I was interested in a way that my parents would sign off on and fed right into my ideas of social and political awareness.
So in that respect, then would you say maybe you're an activist first?
You know, I'm hesitant to say that only because I feel like that I would be so full of myself to say that I'm an activist. But I definitely
or thinker.
I'm a thinker.
Maybe.
But I identify mostly with design and then being able to apply it directly to activism. So on my business card, it says designer, and the next word is activist, but I'd like to use this medium as a way for activism. And so in some ways they're equivalent, and in other ways it's that medium that I have so much direct contact with, and then the activism is a result of my direct action with design.
Mm-hmm. In the program you were studying in, was there a focus on corporate design, or did they embrace the idea that you wanted to use this for social change or activism, or how did you find that?
Well, in my undergraduate program, and I have an MFA in design from California College of the Arts, but in my undergraduate program, and you know, I went in the late 80s, and so this was not a cool thing to do at the time. you know, global warming was just becoming on the radar, was just coming out, really, and no one really believed it at the time, and it wasn't cool not to use spray mountain foam board at the time. But I stuck with it, and the head of the department was really supportive of what I was trying to do, and I was at the time really the only one who was interested in this type of use of design. But later on in the grad program that I went to, and I actually just left that grad program at the end of this summer, beginning of the summer in May 2009, that program was much more supportive, because I think that people are seeing activism as a legitimate way of using design now. But in the late 80s,
you think it's just a matter of time and not maybe location in education? Like, you think it's more a matter of it being, you know, 2005, 2006, as opposed to people who have gotten a bachelor's degree and are kind of looking at the world in maybe a bit of a different way?
You know, I bet it's both. I would think it's both. I think that these issues are so much more on the front page now. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think that more and more people are interested in a visual medium, are seeing a way of applying it that feels productive. And I also think we've had a shift in generations. I think with this newest generation coming of age, the millennials, the Generation Y, the people who are, let's say, age 16 to 29 right now, are so much more globally minded and politically minded that the rest has followed. So the education has followed. So that old school education, the old guard, has had to adjust their ways to adjust for this next generation that is so much more politically and globally minded. I just came a generation too early.
And now you can be an educator for them.
Yeah, right, definitely.
And so you said you are a professor now, correct?
Yes, I'm a professor. I've been teaching at Sacramento City College for 14 years. Before that, I taught at UC Davis Extension and UC Berkeley Extension, and some other smaller places around UC Davis. And so I started teaching. I was hired at Sacramento City College when I was 26, which, you know, I went through this interview, and they don't ask you how old you are, but I made it out like I was a lot older, and somehow got hired and got this tenure track position, and then actually got tenured, and then I was the department chair for 6 years, and at some point I realized, you know, I'm doing all this on just a bachelor's degree and some experience working in design studios in San Francisco and in Sacramento. And I really needed to go back and reevaluate the way I thought about everything. And I wanted to get back into the idea of using design for political and social good. So this is why a few years ago I went on this quest to find a graduate school that would support this type of work.
Mm-hmm. So what was did you have a mission in mind when you went to find this graduate school, or did you just want to do some kind of activism that would
change
the world?
I was pretty focused. So it had to be the right school. It had to be the school that was going to support experimentation and the idea of how design can liaison into environmental and social action. They had to be supportive of that. And I found that the best school for me was in California. It was in San Francisco, which is, you know, incredibly progressive place. But I looked at probably 20 schools, and I visited maybe 6 of them to try to find the school that wasn't emphasizing portfolio building so much as they were emphasizing design thinking. Mm-hmm. So I didn't need the portfolio, after so many years being out of school.
So what was differentiated about this school from the other ones besides that? How were they emphasizing design thinking, and what sorts of things were coming out of the school?
Well, there was a lot of reading that was related somewhat to design that was a lot about philosophy and psychology. I mean, we read a whole bunch of Freud and things that you can see can be related to design or related
Right.
to making, but can be applied to a whole bunch of other areas. So I really liked how CCA was, or this particular program was able to give a more holistic approach to design, and then I could take it in any direction I wanted to. But in my first semester there, and really even before I went, I realized that this place was a little crazy and that they would let me try things that I felt no one else was going to let me try.
Like what?
Well, for example, the idea for me, and when I finally did get to my thesis semester, was to redefine our notion of what a protest is, to undermine design in a way to redefine protest in a way that I think would speak better to this next generation, these millennials. And so trying out things that were actually anti-design and anti-establishment and even anti-CCA, which is an experiment that I did that didn't go over so well, or not as well as I had hoped. But yeah, I held a corporate sponsorship teach-in on campus. And that was pretty controversial. I had just been removed or removed myself from a class that was corporately sponsored. It was a futurism class, and 6 weeks into the class, we were told that Intel was sponsoring the class. And so here I'd been doing all this reading about privatization and how corporations are owning our education and owning all the public land. And so Intel came in. They said, "We want you to sign this. Everyone has to sign it. You're going to give us a forever license to anything you ever make in this class." So
Wow.
I hit the roof pretty much. I refused to sign. I got nasty. And after I refused to sign it, two other students also stepped forward. So we held a corporate sponsorship teach-in in the middle of the nave, which is the giant area, the main area of CCA. And I was on my way to using design as a way to undermine design, and as a way to undermine the corporation. And I started rethinking the idea of the poster, which is the quintessential icon of social movements, and also a medium that I had always been interested in undergrad too in the late 80s. So the idea was, if I could democratize the poster, then maybe that would start to talk about democratizing this idea of corporate sponsorship, or really to me, undoing it. It was an oxymoron to democratize corporate sponsorship. So I started with a poster that actually, it's analog, but it asked people who were reading it to make it, to actually form the poster. So the poster structure was a series of questions and statements about corporate sponsorship. And then there were lots of blank spots in outlines for other people reading it to either answer the question or write their own. And so every poster had a different form when we were done. And then I culled the answers from the posters and the questions from the posters to make the questions for this teach-in. It was a discussion panel type teach-in. And so we used all the questions that students had written. But the idea was to democratize this, what's normally a pretty dictatorial medium. You put it on the wall, people must read it, you can't escape it, but instead have it be formed by the people who also have to read it.
Was this something that the school, you mentioned that the school was not okay with something else you did done. Was this if you did you have these posters placed around campus?
Oh yeah, I had them in every bathroom stall. That was the absolute best place to put a poster. You hung a pencil from it, and people would, sit on the john and write. It was
How
amazing.
did you avoid these posters getting torn down by faculty or
Oh,
staff?
they were torn down, definitely. So I started it before I did those posters. I started with a teaser, and I had one poster. They were little mini posters, and one said CCA Inc. So the idea that CCA was becoming this corporation, and the other one said, it was the opposite argument, which said, "This will prepare me for the real world." So I needed to provide both sides of the argument if I was to have a fair discussion or fair teaching about it. And so I hung those up, and the CCA Inc. ones got torn down every freaking day. And so I started actually having a dialogue through these little mini posters where somebody was tearing the same one down every day and I was hanging it up every day and we went back and forth. And finally, whoever it was that was tearing it down, I never figured out, only tore off the ink part. They left CCA and they tore off the ink.
Oh, interesting.
So they were trying to tell me something. I mean, it was clear. We were communicating. Like, this is design. We were communicating.
Graphic communication, yeah.
So then I left this person a note saying, I really want to hear your opinion about this, but they never called me.
Oh. beyond democratizing the poster design, did you find that the interactive portion was making for a poster that people were paying attention to more rather than just a kind of one-way message directed at people?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, the idea of a feedback loop is, I think, what's going to democratize the mediums, the graphic design mediums. And having it digital, it will definitely create a feedback loop that can't be created any other way. And while the analog posters started to create a feedback loop, and because people were then reacting off of whatever someone else wrote, so there was there was interaction going on, having it digital and eventually creating a digital poster that I projected on the side of the building of CCA, which is a giant warehouse building, definitely got a different reaction. And it also spoke to those millennial nuances of being technologically savvy. And so you could text or go to the internet and fill in a series of questions revolved around food justice. And through this interactive poster, people were forming it in the same way. So that analog poster was a precursor. Was like my first draft of what eventually became an interactive poster that you could get to on the web or through texting. It was projected in a public place, so it looked like a poster, but it was a constantly changing poster, and it was completely formed by the people, capital P.
Wow. Did you find the questions people were sending you to be thoughtful, or did you have to kind of filter anything and find some spam in there? How did that work?
There's definitely spam. But and people are very funny too. I mean, I was cracking up reading what people were writing in the analog posters were just terrific. I mean, people got all off topic about, you know, gay rights and Proposition 8, which was, you know, huge. And there was some funny stuff. They were talking about the admissions office and how rude they are. But then there were some really thoughtful points about how fine art would liaison into this. People would say, well, how does this affect fine arts? How does corporate sponsorship affect fine arts? And I thought that was a really valid question. Some really thought, there was a lot of thought that went into it. And by including everyone and even the formation of the poster, which was what was promoting the actual event, eventually we did do the discussion panel. People came to it. I mean, they promoted it for me or for themselves, right. You know, and so they owned it completely. I mean, not only did they do the promotions for it, all I did was provide a structure and I made it visual. But
well, what's interesting is that you know, through this interactive poster medium, you've made it their communication and their design work as well, and given them some ownership so that they are going to want to go and, I guess, talk to other people about, did you see this poster? Did you see what I wrote on this poster necessarily? And maybe my question will be proposed at this sit-in.
Yep, you got it. That's exactly it. And that's something that I just stumbled upon. I mean, I was doing at the time a lot of reading about this next generation and what was important to them. And the ability to own it, the ability to step into a leadership role. And in this case, it was personal.
And it's easier to step into a leadership role in this way.
Yeah. I mean, they wrote the questions. That's a great role. Mm-hmm. So they wrote the questions. And then after I took the posters down, I put up little mini posters that said, your questions will be answered. And so they knew that what they wrote was going to be addressed. And so they did the teach-in, really. You know, I just provided that structure and framework. And this is where we start to get into this next generation of design, too, is that the designer's role is a lot about making structure and making visual and allowing other people to have the power of designing it. But we're going to get to that later, right?
yeah, absolutely. We can get to it now if you'd like.
Well, you know, I never did mention my other roles here that aren't even on my business card, which just to fill
Go for
in,
it.
I'm also the coordinator of design education for the Designers Accord. And the Designers Accord is a group of designers from any discipline who are interested in environmental and social issues and gearing their practice toward, or at least considering it in their practice, those types of issues and educating clients and things like that. So toward positive change is the idea. And so within my role as coordinator of design education, because I'm also, you know, I've been an educator for 14 years, 15 years, I've been putting together, I've been helping to design a conference that we're actually holding in under 2 weeks now in San Francisco, where we're bringing together 100 design educators and thought leaders from around the world to try to put together a best practices toolkit that will hopefully be adopted by many, many design institutions on how to integrate this into their curriculum and the way that they teach, their methodologies.
Interesting. And how long have you been with the Designers Accord?
I've been with the Designers Accord since January of 08. So I guess a little shy, a couple months shy of 2 years.
And how have things changed in those 2 years? Have you seen more interest and more growth continuing, or has it been fairly steady?
It's been, you know, there was a big surge at about maybe 9 months ago, a big surge of where people were finally really discovering it and finding out about it. And we were getting a lot of really good press. But it started out, it's really, there's only two of us. And it's amazing. There's, you know, over 100,000 firms that have decided to adopt the Designers Accord and abide by the guidelines. But there's two of us who are doing this, and we are working our butts off trying to keep our heads above water. But it's
having a conference. Yeah, it's quite a bit of work.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. And, you know, it's mostly a volunteer position for me until I got back to Sacramento City College, and they are giving me release time, so a partial sabbatical to work on the conference. But before that point, it was completely volunteer for me doing this, like through, I was doing this grad program and working on the Designers Accord. And it's just, it's amazingly positive. People are really positive about it. It's not like a big complaining session. It's more about what can we do now?
What can we do to fix it? Yeah.
Yeah. Instead of complaining about what exists.
That's really good. I'm, you know, with any problem, it seems like the first step is to complain and get all those grievances out, and then you can start to get to the real work.
You know, I think you're right. And I think that many of us who are involved in the Designers Accord, whether we adopted it or are heavily volunteering, have already complained for years and years. You know, for me, it started when I was 16, complained. And now I'm ready to stop complaining, and I'm ready to, like, to work to get this done. And I'm ready to bring other people along with me.
Something Matt and I had discussed in a previous episode dealing with environmental issues is it seems like in some respects a lot of corporations and even young designers might this appears as a fad to some of them, or whether it be the corporations or not, or they're trying to make it into a fad and they're just jumping on the bandwagon. What are your thoughts on that? Do you see that? Do you think that it's something that, yes, it might be a fad now, but eventually it's just going to people are going to stick with it so long because it's the popular thing to do that it'll just become the norm, and thus that's okay?
You know, that's a great question, and I've definitely struggled with that question, and I've gone back and forth between, okay, well, if it is a fad, is that so bad? And could we make this a fad that people would really like? To, you know, screw them. I don't want a fad. I want this to be real. But in the end, I think this is something we have to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have to do it for our own survival. But the designers are the thought leaders. I mean, the designers are the ones who lead the image. I mean, back to the image again. We create what's desirable. And so if we can use our skills to make this, all right, maybe it started as a trend, but for it to be long standing, and it must be for our own survival, then I think we're going someplace. And I'm definitely interested in that, empowering people or other designers. And, you know, it's a lot of reason why I teach is empowering other designers to fulfill their own will, which would, and, you know, and hopefully a lot of them want to, quote unquote, save the world. But in whatever, if it's going to be trendy or if it's going to be real, it's just got to happen.
Yeah, as long as it's getting the job done one way or another, I guess it doesn't matter.
Yeah, what pisses me off is companies like Chevron, who spend more money on creating billboards about how environmentally correct they are than they do on being environmentally correct.
Yeah.
It's just disgusting.
That's a good point.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, they're definitely we've talked about the downsides of the trend, but I kind of think that even if it is a trend for right now, like how bad can it really be that there's a trend of people trying
paying
to think
attention
sustainably
to it
and think about the environment. I mean, at least it's getting the thought out there, and hopefully it can evolve into the next stage where that's just the way we design things.
Yeah, it needs to become part of our DNA as designers. And I think with groups like the Designers Accord, and there's many groups, it's not just the Designers Accord, that are making this part of the DNA of education and of design. And when we, you know, one of your teachers, Scott Boylston, which is how you guys found me, you know, he and I have talked about getting into the old guard, like getting through to the old guard. And it's just, it has to be part of the DNA, and it needs to be part of how we educate the next generation of designers.
Mm. What are your thoughts and what's your advice for students and new professionals out there? As an educator, have you seen this change? Do students nowadays seem to care more inherently? And whether they do or they don't, what's your advice to students and young professionals on, I guess, being more involved and making more conscious decisions?
Well, it's funny that you asked if students are more involved. This semester was the first time I started class. I gave them a survey, and one of the questions on the survey asked them if they wanted to ever use design to make their world better. I'd never asked them that before. And I was really curious to see how people would answer, especially like at a community college where a lot of them are just trying to get by themselves. You know, some of them have extra parts of themselves that are able to give, but many of them are just, I'm just trying to keep them there a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But many, many of them, I'd say maybe 70%, you know, and they could rank it 1 through 5, 5 being that they feel that way the strongest. I'd say that about 70% of them felt significantly that design was something that they could use to make their world better, whatever that meant to them.
Wow.
So that was great. But advice wise, I would say that, you know, people who aren't interested in that, first, I can't even relate to how you could not be interested in wanting to make your world better. But I think that maybe they have some other stuff going on that they need to take care of themselves first and then get to it. But I can't imagine coming of age now as a designer and not being aware of how you need to address those issues.
Well, you know, in some ways, I wonder if that is what is attracting so many people in our generation, you know, this current generation of new professionals and students to design is that, I guess maybe in the 80s and 70s, it was that idea of self-expression. But now we live in a much more global world with the internet, everything, text messaging and all of that. And self-expression isn't just about personal self-expression, but expressing an idea of who you are and what is around you. And I wonder if that idea of basically speaking for, kind of like what you said earlier, speaking for the animals, speaking for the environment, speaking for the poor or anything like that, if designers feel that it's their responsibility now and that's what attracts them to design.
Well, the other thing is just the idea of design is problem solving, and what's the biggest problem we have right now? If you're working in a medium that attracts problem solvers, of course, I think the main idea is going to be to solve the biggest problem we have. And
which one is that?
dealing with our own environment is probably right up there.
Yeah, it's front page news, definitely. I think that, I wanted to comment on how you said self-expression. You were talking about self-expression. Mm. And I agree that was, you know, in the 80s and the early 90s, it was a lot about self-expression. I think people did design because they couldn't do art. But I think what people, especially this next generation, and you know, they grew up, or you guys, I'm going to assume you're part of that, grew up volunteering. I mean, it was part of how you graduated high school. And I didn't have that. You didn't have to volunteer. You just had to get to school and do your homework. But you guys grew up with the sense of volunteering, and you also grew up with the sense of ownership. And so I think if those two can be combined, so I think if this idea of self-expression and, you know, speaking for the animals, but that voice needs to be your own expression.
Right.
I think
the
combination of those two is what really makes this next generation of designers tick, is being able
Absolutely.
To own that voice. So it still is self-expression, but also being able to use that volunteering spirit and apply it in their own voice and to own it and to be a part of something bigger. Collaboration is another thing that I did not grow up with, that you guys did. So if you can design something, and, you know, I set out in grad school to redefine the protest, getting back to that. If you can design something, and in this case, it was eventually an event that I designed, that allowed people to freely express, you know, using their own voice, to be able to populate that poster and at the same time use that volunteering and collaborative spirit to work together on a project that's not too confrontational, which is another problem that, that people have these days, is freely expressing their political commentary. If you can do all that, I think we're actually on to something. And that's what, in my graduate thesis, what I stumbled upon is if I could put all these different nuances, these different cultural nuances of this next generation of designers together, that I could make something that redefined the idea of protest. And that's what culminated in the FARM. And the FARM stands for Future Action Reclamation Mob. And it sounds pretty radical with that mob part, but it needed that edgy piece for people to come out and to really see this as a type of alternative form of nonviolent protest. But what the FARM is a specific, like a site-specific case study of using these nuances, these new design nuances, to do something that was, and you know, when we define protest, it's an overt reaction to things that are going on around you. Only the old definition of protest is that you would do it publicly and forcefully. So the new definition of protest, and you know, this is what I sought to partly to design as this definition, is to do this publicly and productively. And there's my positive thing again, instead of not necessarily forcefully, but publicly and productively. And it's that productive word, that positive part, that I think engages this next generation of people who want to do design for social good.
Mm-hmm. And how did the FARM get started? What was that all about?
The FARM was me trying to, you know, I started with this corporate sponsorship teach-in, which was like a mini case study, which led me to the FARM. The FARM was a way of engaging this millennial generation, you know, your generation, to actually protest, which is, if you ever go to a traditional protest, you know, the ones that are at Powell and Market Street with, you know, the cable car turnaround, and yeah, there's a bunch of, you know, forgive me, old people who are holding signs, and they're angry and they're chanting, and then they have one speaker at a time with these sort of dreadful speeches about their son who's in Iraq, and you know, I spend the entire time at those things crying. Like, it is the most depressing thing to go to. And so I had started to attend these. When I moved to San Francisco, I started to attend these, and I'm looking around and I realized that I'm the youngest person there. So I started this investigation with this question of, where is everyone? Like, where is this next generation? I mean, I went to the Iraq War, you know, it was called the Persian Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm, you know, back in the 90s when I was an undergrad. And we were there. I mean, my generation was there, and we were yelling and we were angry and we were also having a fun time. But I didn't see my equivalent generation at any of these events. So I started the investigation with, where is everyone and how can design bring them back? And what I came to realize is that design may never bring them to a traditional protest or an old school protest, that design could bring them to an alternative protest, though.
So the protest had to change, not the way to get them there.
Yes, and that's what took me months and pain to realize, is they were not coming. I mean, and some will, there's always exceptions, but they were not comfortable going in the middle of the street as much as old generations used to be, unless it was something that was so blatantly human rights violation. So with Proposition 8, where they outlawed same-sex marriage, people came to the street, and your generation came to the streets, but it had to be, and to me, that is just such a violation of human rights. So people came out, but for something like the Iraq War, which is, you know, been going on for way too long,
right? Yeah,
they weren't coming, and even though they didn't agree with it. So, and you know, what we're noticing more and more, and I'm getting back to this whole privatization thing, and this is what was really driving me. So I had a few things coming together. It was, how can design, What is design's role in bringing this next generation to be more political and to actually attend a protest? And then specifically, I am interested in privatization and how privatization has changed the culture of everything, and the way that we, our expectations even of ourselves, or what we get and what we don't get, and education and things like that. You may know about California's financial problems right now, and you know, this is, to me, I can trace everything back to privatization. I mean, any of these things, I can take a chart and it, I always seem to be able to blame it on a corporation. But how could I do this specifically for privatization? I was very interested in this corporate sponsorship thing that's been on the rise. You know, schools are now selling the names of classes to
Wow.
corporations, and this is seriously dangerous. You know, that next thing they'll be teaching it.
Absolutely.
And they are. In fact, if you go to UC Berkeley, they actually have it right open and honest on one of their pages on their website that if you donate X number of dollars, you will be invited to teach the class.
Wow.
It's amazing. I mean, it's right
Wow.
there on their website. I could send you the link. It's amazing. I couldn't believe it. So this is the trend, privatization. And your generation grew up with privatization. You're used to it. It's nothing new. But how can I? Okay, so back to the farm. The idea of privatization, and you know, I could talk forever about Reaganomics, but we have an increase, we have a huge problem in San Francisco called homeless people. And they the homeless population since the 80s has risen tremendously. I mean, it's to the point where we try to pretend like we don't see them. And
It's hard not to.
it's really hard not to. In fact, I realize that it's not that they're invisible, it's that I wanted to be invisible to them. I realized this through the project.
That's a good point, yeah.
But on Hooper Street, which is where we eventually built the farm, there are three populations that frequent Hooper Street. Now, Hooper Street is an industrial piece of land. It's filled with lead. CCA used to be a Greyhound maintenance station. So if you remember lead gasoline, which is actually still around, it's all in the soil. It's disgusting. In fact, the strip of
Wow.
land is has so much lead in it that it can't be used as a playground, nothing. I mean, you're not supposed to do anything
Wow.
with it. So there's three populations that frequent this really rather gross street. The CCA students, there's a homeless population, and there are day laborers. So we have these three essentially transient populations. And I thought this street has potential. There are so many problems. It's disgusting. There's hypodermic needles. There's poop. I mean,
Wow.
everything on the street, and it's where you park to get to CCA. And so a lot of homeless people are able to stay there, and the cops don't bother them because, you know, nobody's on the street. It's only a quarter mile long. So there's a land strip. There was like a parkway strip of dirt that's 10 feet wide by the entire quarter mile, and that's where we found, you know, all the hypodermic needles and stuff. And I'd been watching the strip of land since I arrived at CCA, and I thought, well, why do we not do anything with this land? And so people started parking on it, and that's even worse for the land. But you would just avoid this strip. And I realized that if I was going to do another experiment, and with this, and I'm specifically interested in this next generation of designers, that I needed to find a site that had a lot of them near it. And this strip of land was just perfect. It gave me
Oh, yeah.
problems, and it gave me access to hundreds of millennials, you know, this generation of designers. So my research led me to growing food. And I don't know if it's my old days with that cow shitting on me or what, but it was, I realized that this needed to be something radical, that these students at the school who are basically, you know, urban students of privilege, had never worked on a farm, had probably, most of them had never planted anything in their lives, might find it to be really rad to be a farmer. So this was not going to be a garden. This was going to be a farm. And by calling it a farm, it made it so much more tempting than calling it a garden. And
Made it more edgy
it
again.
did more edgy with the mob thing. And so we had I put up I designed some posters that said, what do you want to do with Hooper Street? They're found on our website. They're, by the way, everything I have is under Creative Commons and available for anybody to use and remix in any way they want.
Oh,
It's my
great. Oh, great.
anti-privatization move here.
Nice.
But it's a photo of Hooper Street, which is, you know, totally disgusting. It says, what do you want to do with Hooper Street? I left some colored pencils, and people again formed a poster, you know, in the analog way. And then I did the digital poster, which had five questions, or actually, yeah, five six questions around food justice, and they formed the questions too. So as students answered the food justice questions, the poster grew. So the most popular question grew the largest, and the answers grew larger, and they piled on top of each other until by the end of 24 hours, you have this giant mess of text. And you know, most of it's pretty ugly, but it's the idea is it's democratized, it's designed by the
Right.
people. The designer just creates the framework and makes visual, and the people do the design. So this enticed people to come. Now, the biggest answer to what should we do on Hooper Street was more parking. I'll admit it. People want parking. It made me so sad. But the second biggest answer was they wanted a garden. And we had an interest meeting, and the parking people didn't show up. No wonder. Only the garden people did. So we decided we'd make a garden, was the idea, which was what my idea was the whole time. And so we sought out to do this. We got everything for free. The idea of farm is that it works on a gift economy. And a gift economy is everything is gifted to each other. I mean, we gift out and things gift in, and the relationships are not built through capitalism, but relationships are built through the exchange of things to build relationship primarily, as opposed to gains, instead of gaining something. So we got all kinds of donations. And again, this is me trying to get people involved in a protest. Keep that in the back of your head as we go here. Using different design experiments with poster, primarily the idea of poster and redefining it for this generation. And so all these students got involved. They all wanted to be farmers. We started calling ourselves farmers, which again stands for Future Action Reclamation Mob. We had pins that said we were farmers. And on March 28th, when we actually held the big farm day, I didn't know how many people. I was hoping for 20 people to show up and farm, and over 50 people showed up, and we farmed it. We farmed the impossible, pretty much. So this.
And so you were going against the city at this point,
Oh
or?
yes, the city. Let me talk about the city. So the idea is we were going to do this anyway, whether the city approved it or not. But just as a token of good faith, which is a lot of what your generation expects, you know, do things the right way. My generation would say, fuck it, let's just do it anyway. But your generation wants to do it the right way. So I applied to farm this, or to garden, urban garden, the street. And in unprecedented timing, in under a week, it usually takes several months, they approved it. I have no, I in fact, I was kind of hoping that they wouldn't. So that I could, so this generation would really do something like technically illegal, would like guerrilla garden. But unfortunately or fortunately,
You can't plant a garden, that's illegal.
it seemed to me like the most ridiculous thing that you wouldn't be able to plant something on this disgusting piece of land. So I was kind of hoping they would not approve it, and we would just do it anyway. But in unprecedented timing, they approved it, and not only that, they gave us $2,000. I have no idea why. So they really like the idea. And again, you know, San Francisco is really progressive. This may not happen in Sacramento, but they gave us money. They totally supported us. They gave us tools. It was disgusting how much they gave us. Totally supportive. And anyway, over 50 people came. We farmed the impossible. We farmed a toxic strip of land. You know, we did some research in advance. We went to Alamedy Farm, which is the only San Francisco farm. They told us it was impossible. What we were doing was entirely impossible. There wasn't enough water. It was too windy. There wasn't enough sun. The street has homeless people on it. They're just gonna ruin it. I mean, all these sort of ridiculous things, and that just made me want to do it more, and everyone else too. So we farmed the impossible. In fact, 2 weeks ago, we just harvested our first giant crop, and we donated it to a place called Free Farm Stand, which gives out food to the homeless people in the Mission District.
Does the lead-based soil not affect the
That's an
crops?
excellent question. It would, yeah. But what we did was we met with, and I learned all kinds of things about agriculture,
Oh yeah,
but we met with
I'm
the San
sure.
Francisco Permaculture Guild. And using this agriculture technique called permaculture, which echoes or mimics the natural ecologies of a forest, we built these giant mounds that were 3 feet away from any lead, and we grew on top of them. And what happens is, over a period of about 2 years, these mounds turn into rich dirt. And so there's a diagram on the website on thinkdiscussact.org where the first layer, there's 18 inches of cardboard. And so we spent hours peeling, you know, staples and tape, cardboard.
Oh yeah.
But eventually the cardboard, which is what mimics the fallen tree in the forest,
Okay.
turns into dirt. It's amazing. And what's
Wow.
on top of it, we put these mycelium spores, which are mushroom spores, helps or increases the rate of decay. And then there's compost and wood chips. And so while we're growing food, we are also creating new soil.
Yeah.
And
So does that clean up the soil that was there
yeah,
before, or are
back to
you just replacing it with new soil?
that. So what, yes, we it would it's not necessarily cleaning the soil. So we have some areas, we have 66 feet that are is growing food on top of lead. And
Okay.
the we don't grow anything that grows down. So no carrots,
Okay.
only collard greens. It's like things that grow up. But the next 36 feet are remediation plots, and they are specifically to clean. So there are certain, and this is amazing to me, but there are certain vegetation that actually will pull the lead from the ground.
Wow.
So using
Wow.
only vegetation, no chemicals, no like digging up, you're not supposed to disturb. If you disturb it, I heard the lead gets even worse. There's so just using corn, sunflower, alfalfa, and mustard, we are pulling the lead from the ground. So what we do is, and we're almost ready for harvest for those. We're going to harvest them, we're going to incinerate them, and you're actually left with the lead.
Wow.
Yeah,
Really?
I cannot freaking wait to see it.
And how long does that have to go before that soil would be clean?
Well, we're gonna, we don't, I don't know. You know, like I'm not a farmer, really. I know it's on my business card.
I bet our listeners didn't expect to get a little education on lead-based soil today.
Yeah, you know, I don't really, to be honest, know what the hell I'm doing in most of this, but I'm learning as I go, and I never started this project with the intention of actually being a farmer. It just, you know, it happened. But I guess what we do is we test the soil again. You take these samples and you send it to University of Massachusetts. They have a testing lab, and then they send back the results, and we'll see. You know, I have the old results, and so we'll compare. And then we'll keep doing it until we actually move the farm to the clean land.
So this was a learning experience on so many levels.
This was the trippiest thing I've ever done in my life. It's, you know, I started this, I had, you know, thesis advisors who were like, how is this design? I mean, this, we kept going back to how is this design? How is this design? And really this whole idea and all this knowledge I got about agriculture is like a side hobby now. It has nothing to do so much with design, but designing the space that we created. And, you know, we had a lot of architecture students who were farmers, and they spent a lot of time trying to figure out how this space would engage people to sit in it. So we built, or I didn't, but the architecture students built a bench that would interact with it, was placed in a way that people could sit actually in the farm. And the industrial design students built a rainwater catchment system on the roof.
Oh, wow.
And you know, I was part of that. We used all materials that we found. Remember, everything at the farm is free. We found or were given was given to us, including the dirt, the seeds, all the materials. So we ended up using part of CCA, the siding of CCA that was extra from a construction job to catch water for the rainwater catchment. And you know, how is this design? Well, in terms of graphic design, which is, you know, my love where I am, it was about getting people there. And after that, it was about keeping people there. So what I'm finding is that design is expanding. I mean, this whole next generation, I like to talk about the next paradigm of design, is that design is not just what we always thought it was. It's not just specific mediums. It's becoming a way of communicating visually, but also how do you design an event that engages people visually and also in terms of its activities that will keep them there, will change their behavior, which is a lot of how I would design, how I would describe design, is design changes behavior. Design makes the complex simple. And if you can make the complex simple and people understand it, you can change their behavior.
And how did it
Wow.
change their behavior? Like, did you notice any differences with the farmers from the beginning to the
You know,
end?
I that's a great question. I at the end of this whole thing, I said, okay, we built this farm, we're growing food, we did the impossible, but did they ever understand that we were making a protest? And it kind of went back to that. And so I interviewed some of them, and I figured they would say, oh no, I just like gardening. And you know, I had, of course, the worst possible scenario in my head that they didn't get it at all, it didn't even work. And I interviewed him, and sure, there were people who said, I like gardening, but there were some amazing things said. One guy said, it added meaning to my life. Now, if
Oh,
that's
wow.
not changing behavior, I don't know what is. And
Yeah.
someone else said something about I asked him why they were a farmer. They said to undermine the corporate structures. I mean, they got
I'm
it.
sure you love
Yeah, that's my
that.
favorite. And they got it. A lot of them did, and a lot of them talked about that this was a way to build community, and that's what I wanted. I mean, community, undermining, changing your life, these are all ways of protesting. These are all ways of overtly and productively making your voice heard, which is what protest is.
Absolutely. I have one other question, and then Matt, you can ask your questions too. How did it affect the homeless population? You mentioned them.
Yes. So it also felt important, and you know, going back to this whole farm day, it felt important that the homeless population, the day laborers, be invited, that this was their street too. And I thought this would blow the minds of this next generation. They all say they want to help the homeless, but do they really want to farm with the homeless? You know, do they really want to farm with the day laborers? So I went anytime, you know, I hung out on that street day after day and flagging down homeless people on their bikes or with their dogs and in telling them what we were doing. Hey, we're building a farm here. You know, you're welcome to help us. You're welcome to eat from this. Anyone can eat. Anyone can work. And homeless people, not so interested. I talked to some
Really?
people later, and they mentioned that, first of all, homeless people don't know what to do with a radish. They don't know how to either cook it, or they may not have the gear for cooking it. But the day laborers, they were interested. But the other problem too with the homeless is that I wasn't providing them a shower. I mean, they were going to get dirty and do all this work, and
True.
then what? They probably didn't want to be all dirty and working. In fact, later on when we grew this huge crop of strawberries, hundreds and hundreds of strawberries, which was hard. People don't want strawberries as donations because they rot too quickly. But
Okay.
we only grow what comes to us. So somebody donated strawberry plants. That's what we grow. That's how it works. But we were growing strawberries, and I was out there over the summer because that's when they grow. And I'm harvesting strawberries, tons of them. And there were two homeless people who came by with their dogs, and I asked them, like, do you guys want some strawberries? And they asked me, well, are they safe to eat? And so here are these people, they're filthy, they have dirt under their fingernails, they look like they've been through hell sleeping outside. And I'm offering them organically grown, you know, permaculture strawberries,
Yeah.
and they want to know if they're safe or if they're dirty. And so I said, you know, you can eat these anytime you want. You see, they're growing. School's not even in session. You should just come here and eat them. And her response to me is, well, how do I know when they're ready? So there's such an alienation to food. I mean, how do you not know when a strawberry is ready? It's red.
Kind of goes back to that, the corporation thing and the pre-manufactured, you know, McDonald's. And
it didn't come in a package. How
yeah,
did
it didn't.
You even get it?
And, you know, these
Absolutely.
homeless people are fed all packaged stuff. It's not fresh. They get packaged
Yeah.
sandwiches and those little fruit things with the cornstarch syrup in a plastic
Oh,
container.
yeah.
So they weren't so interested, but the day laborers were on it. And so I went down to the other end of the street. The day laborers and the homeless people don't mix. You know, they don't really talk. But I went to the other side of the street. I brought an interpreter. I don't know enough Spanish to communicate effectively. He introduced me. We told him what we were doing, and they were excited about it, you know, to some degree. I wasn't sure if it was just lip service or what. But when we had our farm day, Mario was our day laborer who came and joined us. And so he farmed with us. He took community breaks with us. He ate with us. He played with my daughter, who, you know, my daughter doesn't know the difference between a student and a day laborer. She just wants to play. So he played with her. I mean, there was no fear. I could tell that the students weren't 100% comfortable with it, but he went looking for us week after week. He kept asking. He couldn't remember my name, but he kept asking people, where is the woman? That's what he called me, because I'm apparently the oldest one there. And where's the woman? Where's the woman? And so whenever I found him, he was amazing. I mean, he farmed with us all day, and I'm hoping that he comes and eats. And I've brought food to him while he's been waiting out on the corner for a pickup or job. But I was so glad that he came. And, you know, he's in my paper, my newspaper, which is going to be in Communication Arts Design Annual next month.
Oh, perfect.
So
I've seen it too. Boylston has a few copies, and so that's actually, you know, how I wanted to talk to you, is after reading that. But It's very
Yeah,
nice.
thank you. It also just won first place in the AIGA Redesign Awards. And my idea here is, thank
Congratulations.
you. I
Congratulations.
mean, it's very exciting, but what I'm thinking is that when people see it on that, it's great press that they'll make their own farm.
Yeah, and it's so
That's
radically different for graphic design too to see in something like Com Arts or as an award-winning thing. People see these like, oh, look at that flashy poster, that flashy
Yeah.
package design. Whereas this, I don't know how it's being laid out in the magazine or how much attention it'll get, but if they show enough detail and talk about it in enough detail, like hopefully it'll open people's eyes to this can be design, this is design, this is what design should be in many respects.
Yes.
And that was going to be my next question, is how do you expand from here? Because it sounds like an incredible success.
Yeah, thank you. The way I expand from here is I entered as many competitions as I could, and not so much because I wanted to be the winner of them, although I must admit it's been a lifelong dream of mine to be in the Communication Arts Design Annual. I mean, let's be honest. But because I thought the more attention this gets, the more farms can be made. And so I printed 1,000 of those papers that you saw, the newspaper. It's a 56-page paper. And the idea was that while one garden, one 66-foot edible garden, it's nice, but it does not make a revolution, nor does it start to impact the problems we have locally or nationally or globally. But that if we had one garden times 1,000, that might start to do something. And so Hooper Street, the CCA garden is a case study, is a test case for what could be. And my hope is that people will read this. They know exactly how to do it. It's all outlined. All the files are available for them to do. Even the interactive poster, it's built in Flash. If you know just a little bit about Flash, you can change your questions if you want. And you can use all the materials to make your own farm, and that we have like a farm collective, a farm network. So I moved back to Davis, which is where I live normally. I was just in San Francisco for the 2 years. And we are having our first Farm Davis interest meeting tomorrow.
Perfect.
So I live in a university town, why not? And there's also going to be a Farm Sacramento, and I have a couple of people who are interested in leading that. And we would like to take in Sacramento some toxic railway yard land and just take it and make it into a farm. In Davis, I decided that, I was thinking about this whole idea of privatization, and I'm looking at my own behaviors, and I'm a homeowner. I mean, this plot of land I live on is private. It's owned by me, and I was thinking about that, and I felt pretty bad about it after all of my talk on making things public. And I started to do some history about the front yard. And it turns out that the front yard used to be public. In fact, that's why we have grass. Is that long ago you were required to have grass on your front lawn because it was public space, not private. So I donated my front yard to farm. And my neighbors think I'm crazy. It took me a month to convince my husband. But we donated our front yard to public space. And there's 1,500 square feet of front yard. And we'll be farming the front yard. We already tore out the lawn, which is a ridiculous waste of water. And we'll be farming it. And I'm just trying to figure out how that fits into the Davis culture at this point. I know how it does in a city like San Francisco, but I'm not exactly sure yet how it fits into Davis. And so I'll be doing a few poster experiments at UC Davis to see how it works.
Sounds great.
Cool.
So I hope you guys build
Well,
one.
oh yeah. I think it's a, no, I Savannah actually would be a good college town to do something like that,
Yeah, it
actually.
would.
All that
There's a
sunshine.
lot of, that's true, and we have a lot of spaces that could probably use some sprucing up, so.
Farm asks that you take a piece of neglected space and reclaim it.
Something we need to look into. Yeah.
Right.
Well, Matt, do you have any other questions?
Well, I'm interested to know about the idea of the paradigm shift and designers designing a structure for other people to then work with, as opposed to the idea where the designer has full control of everything. Like, what are some of your thoughts on that, and how do you see it panning out in the future?
Yeah, thank you for getting back to that. I get off topic. But what I've noticed is in the past 10 years, there's been some shift. There's been two significant shifts. So 10 years ago, it was the designer knows best, and designer would work with the client, and the client would tell you what he thought his people needed, his shoppers needed, and the designer knew best, and the designer would design, and that was kind of the end of it. You went through the client and more recently, I'd say definitely within the past 5 years, we have been shifting to a user-centered design. So human-centered design research is very popular right now. I did a stint at IDEO in San Francisco as an independent study as while I was in grad school, and I ended up doing human-centered design research on human-centered design research. So it was an in-house project where I did research on how they do their human-centered design research. But what that's talking about is how we as designers use our intuition combined with what we learn from the people, it's like capital P, the people, to design. So we talk to them, we try to find out what they, we know what they say and we know what they do, but we try to find out what they think and what they feel through what we're observing about them and through what they say. And we're able to use our designer's intuition to then design appropriately. And so that client is still there somewhere, but not as prominently. And the designer isn't so much a dictatorial role where we know best. So you can see how that shift happened. What I see happening, though, and this is the second large shift, is, and I don't know that it's come yet, but I see it already happening, is as designers now, instead of we know best at all, we know how to make visual, we know how to create structures and systems, and we put it out in the public for the public to decide what to do with it. And you know, if you look at the history of, say, Facebook was never intended to be what it is today. I mean, people made it, they used it, and they reappropriated its features to use it in the way that they do today. Now, a good business will allow that to happen, and a good designer will allow that type of thing to evolve. Now, you know, this is the next paradigm, without going in and trying to change it to what they wanted it to be. So
designers are essentially just the catalyst.
Yeah, I would say that, yeah, they are the catalyst, and they make their decisions, or they design based on what they learned about people, you know, through that human-centered design research, which I did a ton of in making the farm. But they allow it to become what it becomes. It becomes a living, working, breathing project rather than this is what it is, and I'll tell you what you need to know. So no more designer knows best, but designer needs to be more flexible and allow what happens to happen. And the idea of redefining or reworking a poster so that you are not saying what they need to know, but they are saying what they need to know, is in support of this democratization of design, or this next paradigm that I see coming around the corner. Design, I mean, if you look at Etsy, you know, the website Etsy, that is, you know, a structure that is built for other people to fill in to make what they want of it.
Yeah.
That's what
I'm strikes
saying.
Me that's kind of what the entire web is designers setting up structures so that users can post their comments, can post their ideas, post their images, or just any piece of media that they need to put out in the world. Is you're setting up a structure for them to do it.
Yeah.
And is that what you think where the paradigm shift is coming from? Is technology really kind of like the catalyst in the shift?
That is a big player. Technology is a big player. We can do it now. But I think even bigger is cultural. So even bigger is your generation, who grew up with so much leadership and so much collaboration. You guys expect to be given responsibility. That's something that's new to this, that we haven't seen a generation like yours since the people who fought in World War II, who actually took leadership roles. I mean, I did what I was told and then got pissed off and became rebellious. You guys just, you do, people, the baby boomers that raised you, empowered you to do these things. And it's expected now that you should be part of design in every way, whether you're a designer or not, that you should be the ones building it. So definitely technology combined with these cultural nuances that I'm seeing coming from your generation combine to change this next shift. New paradigm.
Yeah.
Nice. I like the positive take on it too, because I feel like I hear so much about our generation and the negative aspects involved in it, but there is, I do want to be a part of a positive positive change, and hopefully prove that some of our paradigms are for the better, not for the worse.
Yeah, and you know, honestly, I have to admit that when I started all this research, I was focusing on your generation because I thought you guys were assholes.
I think a lot of our generation thinks we're assholes too.
And what I came to learn, and you know, now you guys are my favorite people, is that you're pretty cool. And I just thought you were guys were lazy, but I realized that I was looking at this in the wrong framework. That it wasn't just because you weren't doing what I would have done, didn't make you lazy. You just have a different way of doing it, and I appreciate it.
That's really interesting. I feel like that's something that could be applied to all aspects of life with, and that's just a way of accepting and understanding people a little better, is that if someone's different, it's not because they're lazy necessarily. They just have a different way of doing
Yeah.
things.
Well, it's a nice,
And that's
like,
okay.
anthropological, cultural relativism way of approaching it, as
Yeah.
opposed to
Nice abstract way, yeah.
ethnocentric.
And you know, when we talk about the next shift in design and the paradigm, the next paradigm, I think we can stop calling design and we can stop calling ourselves problem solvers. I think we might want to be calling ourselves opportunity makers and start taking a more positive approach to how we even
It's
describe
really
what we
interesting
do.
too.
I mean, for
That's interesting. I
generations,
like
we've been
that.
calling ourselves problem solvers. But when I see what we're
I mean, I'm
talking about
even.
as a
Yeah.
problem, I see opportunity. I saw that big dirty piece of land as opportunity, not as problem.
I still tend to refer to it that way as we're problem solvers, just because I've heard it so many
Yeah.
times. But I do get I get excited about opportunities more than I do about problems, really.
Okay.
So I guess
Yeah.
that's a more interesting way of looking at it.
You should. That's what your generation does. They're productive. They're not problems. They want to do something good. That would make
Yeah.
sense. Now is the time to change that perspective from problem to opportunity.
Well, opportunity creating. Let's stick with that. I think that's it. We're at about an hour now, and it's been wonderful talking with you. I think we had some great discussions. Matt, anything you want to wrap up with?
I'll just ask Robin, is there anything else you want to say before we go?
Oh gosh. You know, I think I've probably said too much.
Not at all. No, this has been wonderful. Thank you.
I would like people to read this thesis that I wrote. I mean, even if you just want to read what a thesis looks like.
We're going to put up links to it on the show notes as well, to Designer's Accord, to your thesis. All right, well, thank you so much for coming on once again and, you know, giving us your time. This has been great, and we'd love to have you back on again. So, we'll keep in touch. Thanks.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank L1011 again for letting us use their wonderful music. This song is called K10. As always, you can find us online at rbtl.us or readbetweentheleading.com. You can email us at readbetweentheleading@gmail.com, and you can find us on Twitter at rbtlshow. As always, I'm Aaron Heath.
And Matt McInerney.
Thanks for listening.